Hello and welcome to Securities, an audio and video podcast, plus a newsletter discussing science, technology, finance, and the human condition. I'm your host, Danny Crichton, and today we're talking about one of the most philosophically expansive and intricate hard sci-fi books out there, Blindsight. Blindsight is the first of two books in the Firefall series written by Peter Watts back in 2008, and it's a wild ride of dozens of ideas, some of which we'll talk about today. Spoilers abound, so caveat emptor. Joining me today is Sam Arsman, a common guest here on Securities, because Sam, you're employed here at Lux.
We always
grab your time. Sam is our scientist in residence here at Lux Capital. And joining us as a special guest is Gordon Brander. Gordon runs the company Subconscious, which is building tools of thought, such as NewSphere, which is a decentralized network of your notes backed by IPFS, as well as Subconscious, which is a social network built around those notes that allows you to think together with others. Think of it as a multiplayer version of Rome. Gordon, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
We're going to talk today about a bunch of different concepts, from the distinction between consciousness and intelligence, Searle's Chinese Room, the Scrambler Consciousness Test, whether consciousness is necessary for intelligence, and then, just for fun, a look at intelligence and the large language models that have sprung up around generative AI. Or maybe we won't do any of that stuff because we are intelligent, conscious beings who can completely ignore everything that we hammered out on the pre-production call. Who's to say? That's what makes these podcasts interesting. And let's just put it bluntly, we had a list of about 20, I think, philosophical puzzles from this book. And our producer, Chris Gates, was like, we're going to lose all of our subscribers if you talk about any of these. So with that said, Sam, Blindsight, let's talk a little bit about the plot, because it sounds like an amazing, amazing book that I have not read.
Yeah, It is a lot of fun. There's a ton there. There's even like a massive like appendix where it's like quoting all the different like scientific articles. But in terms of the way I would describe, at least there's a few different ways of describing it. One is, in the same way that there's like people trying to do like the great American novel, this is like the great consciousness novel. Like, this is like just taking the idea of consciousness and really hammering home. But really, I mean, in terms of the plot, it's essentially it's a first contact novel. It's about humanity engaging with an extraterrestrial intelligence. And so the plot basically is like, there's kind of like evidence of some sort of intelligence, like a whole bunch of stuff happens, I think, in the atmosphere of the Earth. And then they send out a whole bunch of probes to some comet that's like sending out some messages. And then eventually the bulk of the plot is this like few person ship that goes to somewhere in the Oort cloud. And there's this ship, this vessel orbiting it, and they have to engage with it. I would definitely say not hilarity ensues. It's kind of like further levels.
A PhD
of like
dissertation ensues. Yeah,
no, it's dark. Very dark. It's like
bordering on cosmic horror. Yeah.
So this isn't Star Trek: The Next Generation, which everyone feels good after 45 minutes. Minus commercials.
No, it is not. No, basically no one feels good really at any point. And it's also very like the characters who are on the vessel, like they're on the ship, like the first contact ship from Earth, they're all like, I would say, outliers when it comes to consciousness in like a number of different ways, and like how people think about the mind, and like, and so that's also, but they're all there for very specific reasons, and so that, coupled with like trying to actually understand this giant vessel which calls itself Rorschach, that's kind of the entire plot. I'm like trying to figure out what is going on, and there's like de-extincted vampires, like it's bonkers and amazing. And
Sam, we talked about this. The vampires are not on the script. We talked about this. So Sam, when did you read the book? You read it when it came out in 2008 or more recently?
No. So I think I had actually tried it years ago, not necessarily when it came out, but like a while ago. And then over the years, like a number of people have been like, oh, like this is really good, and people kind of pointed to it. And finally, and I think I was actually having a conversation with our producer in the context of like talking about like large language models and like the differences between intelligence and consciousness. And I mentioned this book, Blindsight. I was like, oh yeah, like it kind of touches on these issues, and I never really got into it, but I think this could be a fun thing to discuss, and it's definitely worth rereading, or in this case for me, like actually giving it like a full opportunity. And it's, I read it only like in the past like couple months, and it was amazing. And it's like this thing, yeah, that came out almost 20 years ago, because I think maybe it originally came out in 2006, I don't remember exactly. And it nails all of the issues that we're thinking about in terms of large language models and how to think about like, what is intelligence, what is super intelligence, is intelligence the same thing as consciousness?
So Gordon, you run a company called Subconscious, so I think you're the perfect person to talk about consciousness and intelligence. But Gordon, how did you run into the book? Because we crafted this episode because we all figured out that we all had read this book, or you two had read this book, and I could follow along and tag along, much like our audience, I'm sure. But Gordon, how did you run into the book?
Yeah, actually, I was at a Santa Fe Institute conference. Santa Fe Institute is this thing out in Santa Fe. They do complexity science. I think, Sam, you might be connected with them to some degree. But
I years ago, I spent a summer there as an undergrad, and I stayed in touch with a lot of folks and kind of do things periodically with them and help out.
And Josh here at Lux Capital is also on the board of trustees for Santa Fe as well.
Ah, that's right. Yeah.
So we're all intertwined,
There's a fellow there named Michael Garfield who did actually the Santa Fe Institute podcast. We were chit-chatting, and he mentioned this book is just one of the best sci-fi books he had ever read. And yeah, I gotta say, I picked this book up, and it is so dark. It's like an existential crisis in a book. It really makes you question the value of life and consciousness and qualia and all this stuff. But I almost put it down a couple times, and so that was a few years ago. When I picked it back up to do a little bit of a reread before this podcast, I came away thinking this is one of the best hard sci-fi novels I've ever read. And like Sam said, it comes with 17 pages of scientific citations. So the guy did his homework. I think he was actually a practicing biologist at some point.
Well, amazing. Well, I know our last show was on Tomorrow, Tomorrow, and Tomorrow, which is about as opposite of a hard sci-fi book to discuss than this one. But let's dive into the interesting topic. So our first subject was around consciousness versus intelligence. And you had highlighted in our pre-production notes two quotes, one from Thomas Nagel, that consciousness as there is something that is like to be a bat. That is like to be a bat, so like something essentialist to being a type of entity, versus W. Rosh Ashby, which says that intelligence as getting information and doing something about it. So let's talk about this distinction, because it seems to be at the core of the book, and really the core of life and everything we're experiencing today, both for ourselves existentially as well as in large language models.
Yeah, exactly. So that, I think those two quotes really do sort of tease it apart. So Thomas Nagel's kind of notion that there is something that it's like to be a bat. It might be different than what it's like to be me, but I think a bat probably has, experiences and inner life of some kind. There's probably not something that it's like to be a rock, right? But it's interesting because this actually, you might look at that, and since we're sort of conscious beings and we tend to think in this way, you might be, well, I guess that's intelligence, right? But I like Ashby's quote as kind of a counterpoint. So I guess the full quote is, to the biologist, a brain is not a thinking machine, it's an acting machine. It gets information and does something about it. So his point here is that actually, from the standpoint of evolution, evolution doesn't actually care about your qualia, it doesn't care about your inner life. What it cares about is survival outcomes. And it's a little bit of a, I think, hard thing to picture what it might be like to be intelligent without being conscious. But actually, there are examples of this in nature, like an ant. It might be conscious. I don't know. It has like 250,000 neurons compared to like our 10 billion. If it's conscious, it's probably not very conscious, right? It's also not very intelligent. But when you get a bunch of ants together into a colony, actually the colony is very intelligent. The ant colonies will cooperate to use tools to solve problems. But I don't know. I don't think an ant colony is conscious. Like, Sam, what do you think? You're the scientist.
I don't know. I mean, it's so interesting. To be honest, I don't have a personal opinion on ant colony consciousness. That being said, when I read like Gödel, Escher, Bach by like Douglas Hofstadter, like there is an ant colony that like has a name and isn't a character, like in these dialogues that he has. And so like it definitely seems to have some sort of consciousness. But the question becomes, where like could it act in a conscious way? In a Turing test kind of way of like, oh yeah, like it responds in a way that kind of like shows intelligence, but maybe there's like the lights aren't on inside. And like that, and the question then becomes like, how do you know? And the answer is like, people I think are struggling with this. And there are a number of scientists who have like come up with certain metrics on like what would be like the information processing within a system that maybe maybe merits like saying, okay, this system has consciousness. So I'm like, when is a system conscious? When is like the individual components conscious?
Well, it reminds me of in software engineering, there's this concept of duck typing. So, you know, if it walks like a duck and it quacks like a duck, then it must be a duck, right? So this, I think, is getting at the Nagel quote of like, you know, if it seems like a bat and you're looking at it and it acts like one, then it is one. But then I think what you're getting at, Sam, is this deeper question of, you know, sort of at the core of the LLM kind of controversy right now, which is like you ask a question to the LLM, it gives you an amazing response back. It's hyper accurate. It's almost as intelligent. It's certainly more intelligent than a third grader, a fourth grader. Like, where's this kind of divide line? And so clearly duck typing is not enough to characterize consciousness. There's no rational thought. There's no enlightened thinking. There's no kind of like loop. I'm thinking like almost the Santa Fe Institute, but there's no like feedback loop in the complex system that's self-correcting, self-learning. It is just stats, if you will. And so I like this distinction because I do think we're struggling and we're right on this kind of liminal space between the two in software engineering in a way that we're not able to get past.
I think Turing kind of was pulling on that insight too with the Turing test. You know, he's sort of anticipating all of the advancements that would happen with computers and was saying, well, this thing is sort of like a big electronic brain. And what happens if it starts having conscious experiences, qualia, like an inner life? Like, how do we know? And his proposal was basically that we have a dialogue with it and we try to see how it responds. And if it starts responding in ways that seem like it has, you know, consciousness, that there's something that it's like to be a computer, then we treat it as such. Cause you know, the notion is like, I guess I can't get into your head. I can't actually know if you're conscious.
Well, I wonder there though, if there's like, if that means that we're going to always be biased towards more human type, like consciousness, because like we know what it's like to be a human. And like what it's like to kind of have this internal monologue and like things going on inside our heads. And so when we see systems that have similar kinds of outputs, no one thinks that the generative AI systems for images are conscious. Like that hasn't been a conversation because the outputs are so wildly different from what we output, which in this case is like text and thoughts and strings of symbols. I do wonder though, as we think about consciousness, like there probably is this very large set, like high dimensional space of types of consciousness. But right now we're really only able to identify things that seem very human-like.
I remember, I mean, so Gordon, you mentioned, you know, the experience is different than a rock. But what I think is interesting is if you look in the natural world over the last two decades, a lot of scientists have come together to understand how trees communicate. And we're sort of learning in much of the way that I think in the animal world, we learned the same thing over the last couple of decades, that dolphins and whales are these incredibly intelligent creatures. They have languages. In fact, I think we had a Lux Recommends article either last week or in my inbox for this week around that we have started to learn baby talk for dolphins, that we actually now understand that dolphins, like dolphin parents, are using a form of baby talk, a kind of devolved, deformed form of communication, that they're actually in some ways in like a metaphor, right? But we also see this in the plant world. So we are learning more and more about how trees communicate with each other, that they essentially kind of send, let's call it, chemicals into the air that get moved on winds. And so different trees can hear from each other. So if a tree is suffering, other trees actually respond in unique ways. They can strengthen their bark. They can change the structure of the actual plant and how it grows. So they're actually kind of connected. And in the most like, you know, avant-garde way, they're all a consciousness, right? All the trees are sort of communicating with each other and warning each other. It probably happens over hundreds and hundreds of years, to be clear, right? So what I like about this, and then we'll move on to some new other concepts, is like, there's not just intelligence and there's not just consciousness. You can be conscious and not that intelligent, but not that conscious. But you can also have all these other forms of consciousness, which is what Sam was talking about. You can have ant colonies where each individual ant sort of has a little bit of consciousness, but really the intelligence emerges from the colony as a whole. In other cases, we have individual animals that communicate with each other, much like humans, or you have plants where it's almost like a network in a very Santa Fe-like way, a decentralized network of individual entities. I don't know what the right way to call it, because they're not conscious in the way that we would necessarily understand, but they do take in information from the world and bounce it back. They're solving problems, right? And they're going into collecting information. They're getting sunlight, and so I just think it's amazing to see how many parts of that spectrum exist. Where I think we have this very narrow view of like, well, human is conscious, and that's the only way it goes forward. Let's move on. Let's move on to the Chinese Room, because Chinese Room it was a huge part of this book. So we had a couple of concepts, Chinese Room and the Scrambler Consciousness Test. So, Gordon, you just read the book. Do you feel like you can summarize what the Chinese Room and the Scrambler Consciousness Test is?
Yeah, I'll do my best. So I guess the notion is, you know, even on our planet, we have a wide variety of kinds of intelligence, right? An ant colony is intelligent, I'm intelligent, a bat's intelligent. You could say a rainforest or nature or markets are intelligent, and all these things might be conscious or not conscious in different ways. So one of the core questions of this book is, what happens when you run into an intelligence that's completely alien? Like, how do you figure out what's going on? Is it conscious? Is it intelligent? How does it solve problems? How does it think? And a sort of philosophical experiment that's referenced a lot in the book is this concept of the Chinese Room. So the basic background here is you imagine yourself locked in a room, and little slips of paper are coming in under the door. And on those little slips of paper is a language that you don't speak. In the sort of original thought experiment, it was English speaker getting little slips of paper that have Chinese written on them. And in front of you, you have basically a big book. And in that book, you can kind of look up, okay, well, what is this symbol? When I see this symbol, I'm supposed to write this other symbol and then slip another note back out the door. So this is kind of interesting, right? Because if you imagine now you're the person on the other side of that room, the person slipping notes in Chinese under the door. To you, it would seem like whoever's in that room understands Chinese, right? But actually, the person is just kind of looking things up in a book. Like, do they really understand? And I think we've actually been running into some of these questions too with AI. I'm curious, Sam, you might be able to talk a bit more about that.
When this thought experiment was like first proposed, I think it was kind of like viewed as like, oh, this is a slam dunk of showing that like computers can never be conscious. Like, they're just kind of like doing this like symbolic manipulation. The counter argument, I think, is also quite powerful. It's like, okay, like, in the same way that an individual neuron does not understand like what is going on in my mind, this person doesn't understand either what's going on in this room, but the overall system can understand. I think that, and this is like something, and Gordon, you and I think have talked about before, the room might be conscious. The room, like the system understands. So the system can handle these kinds of things. Whether or not it's conscious versus just intelligent, I think like that's an interesting point. But these like LLMs, like individual neuron, like individual artificial neurons, like they're not understanding what's going on. But the question then becomes, okay, does it overall understand? Is it, or is it kind of this like stochastic parrot that is kind of, and this is, I think, kind of the interesting thing. And this is like the, and related to this is kind of the idea of like the philosophical zombie or like the P zombie, which is like, okay, if you have, like there's the philosophical zombie, they're not like, it's not like Walking Dead or anything like that. It's basically just the idea of like, is it like, imagine a person who is just like you, but there is no consciousness. So every interaction would be identical, but there's like, there are no lights on. And the question is like, what does that mean? Is it even possible? And like, now I think with these AI systems, we're beginning to grapple with this. Like, okay, like these systems can obviously interact for significant periods of time with other humans in very human-like ways. And so the question is, are they pee zombies? Are they actually conscious? And I feel comfortable right now, given like the ways in which we can kind of like break them, to say that like they're not conscious yet, at least. That being said, I mean, like, there are ways of breaking humans too. So like, so we have to kind of just like be humble in all of this as well.
I think one of the interesting things, you know, whenever I think about the Turing test, right, it has this concept of you put information in, you're getting reasonable information back. And so you're like, okay, whoever's on the other side. I mean, the Turing test is basically the Chinese Room, right? And I do love the ethnocentrism of the Chinese Room. It could easily be the American Room, which would probably be more accurate for most people's experience around the world. But nonetheless, you know, this idea of you just sort of put stuff in, you get stuff out, it's reasonable. Turing says that that's basically the definition of artificial intelligence. You can't make a distinction. So I'm remembering, like, I think at MIT, there was this project called ELIZA, ELIZA, which was a text-based chatting app back in, whatever, the 60s or 70s. That was actually fairly realistic. You could give it a couple of, like, responses, and it would come back, and, but it was not intelligent in any way, shape, or form. Nothing like the LLMs we had today. It was, I think, pre-wired and was quite contained. And so I think that there has to be sort of a qualitative judgment here, right? We can't just sort of quantitatively, you know, in the LLM world today, there's a lot of benchmarking that's like, okay, if you ask this question, do I get a response? And does that seem to make sense? And that's how we're sort of evaluating a lot of LLM models. There also has to be a qualitative sense of, you know, does it actually like think, right? Does it actually combine different pieces of information together? Can it be fooled because it is being given words in unique ways that sort of messes up with the neurons that are in the neural network? And I'm thinking particularly of Gary Marcus, who was on the podcast last year, who makes a huge distinction between, you know, there's statistical AI and sort of the actual functional rules-based AI, which failed as a discipline, but we lost kind of truth along the way. And so I think that gets at this aspect of, you know, what is really true comes from consciousness or intelligence out of here.
So I definitely think, I mean, there's a lot of things there. I think one thing, I mean, going back to like this, like the kind of stochastic and statistical versus like rules based, I actually think a lot of the rules and symbolic manipulation are emerging at this high level in a much more organic way and robust way than the original rules, like rule, like symbolic manipulation, kind of like the old style. But going back to like the, like Eliza, like the chatbot, one of the interesting things though is like these chatbots and like AI systems are very dependent on like your expectation, like what you kind of put in. So like if you think this is going to be some sort of psychoanalyst, then you're much more predisposed to kind of overlook its weird things where it's like, how does this make you feel? And like it's very strict. I've played with it before. And in the same way that like a lot of these AI systems, like the current AI tools, if we kind of go in thinking that they're going to do certain kinds of things, we're more predisposed to kind of find that. And so I feel like to a certain degree, yes, we do need to have tests, because I think otherwise it's very easy for these systems to become mirrors. And like we see what we want to see. And so I think that's just kind of something to be aware of.
In other words, or art. But Gordon, let me ask you. I mean, I want to talk about this quote here about ambiguous phrasing, because I think a huge part of the book is trying to tease out the distinction. So we have this quote here from the book by Peter Watts. Our cousins lie about the family tree. With nieces and nephews and Neanderthals, we do not like annoying cousins. In the context of theory of mind versus parrot. That's in my notes. And having not read the book, I have absolutely no idea what the context is. But maybe you could take us a little bit of a leap of faith there.
Yeah, actually, Peter Watts loves these two thought experiments, the philosophical zombie and the Chinese room. And actually, in the sequel to Blind Sight, there are literal philosophical zombies, like people who have their consciousness removed for various reasons. So in addition to the vampires, we get scientific zombies. But in any case, most of Blind Sight is actually this team of people trying to figure out this alien thing, spacecraft, entity, we don't know what it is. Is it conscious? Is it intelligent? Or is it a Chinese room? Is it actually a stochastic parrot? Because when they run into it, it's speaking English. And they basically like figure out that, hey, it must have been listening to signals bouncing around like radio and kind of reverse engineered what's going on here. So is it just sort of reflecting back to us like a mirror? What we put into it, or is there something else going on here? So there's a few ways that they try to poke at it. The funny thing is, 20 years later, 10 years later, 20 years later, however long it's been since the book was published, we see LLM researchers doing similar things. So one of them is this ambiguous phrasing trick. So if you think about, you're in the Chinese room, right, and a slip of paper comes in, and that slip of paper, the person who understands what they wrote has deliberately written something that's grammatically ambiguous. Like in the case of that phrase that we heard earlier, our cousins lie about the family tree. This is their response to Rorschach, this alien entity asking about human origins. And so are we saying our cousins are arranged around the family tree? Or are we saying our cousins, are we lying about the family tree to Rorschach, right? And the interesting thing is if you're a stochastic parrot, if you're just predicting the next token, you look up in your little rule book and it's like, well, I'm going to collapse that ambiguity because I actually don't have any ability to kind of recursively reflect on what I just read and intuit that there's something wrong here, that there's like a halting problem. So we would expect that there, at some level of recursion, there'll be like a bottoming out, like a flattening of the ambiguity, and that the alien, or let's say LLM, is going to actually hallucinate a response that's very confident, but might ignore all of those ambiguities.
Obviously, language and consciousness are very intertwined, at least from the human perspective, right? When we think of consciousness, we think of people able to communicate using their languages. And I study foreign languages, and I always have this argument around fluency. That, you know, even in English, if you talk to medical doctors, like in the ER, like, I have no idea what they're saying, right? You go to the air traffic controllers and you're a pilot. I have no idea what they're saying. They're speaking English, and I speak English, and I'm a native speaker of English, but I have no idea what's being communicated. And so it's not just enough to know a specific language at some base level. Like, there's domains, there's technical terms. Sam, you were a PhD in biology. Like, you start talking about Western blotting tests, and I'm like, I have no idea what you're getting at whatsoever. Northern blotting, Western blotting, Southern blotting. I don't know. Can you do a Southwest, more Santa Fe style blotting? I don't even know. You know, so
by
there's
the way,
all this.
Initially, as an aside, initially it was based on a person's last name. Like, which I don't remember if it was Western or Southern, and then based on, and then as like, kind of as a play on that, it was like the guy's name, and then they just started making cardinal directions, which is like a fun little side.
So. Right. So this is a good example. So to me, you know, we look at language, and I think that's where this Chinese room gets really interesting, is at some point we are all just kind of trying to use symbolic language, right? Like, when I speak in a foreign language, I can get pretty good. I know what it's saying, and then I write the response, and I'm like, you know, do I know, okay, there's 20 synonyms for funny, but, you know, is it sardonic, ironic, is it wry? There's so many different slight nuances to these words, and I just don't know them, right? Like, I don't use these languages enough to be able to communicate at that level. And so am I conscious? You know, like, what's interesting to me is when I speak a foreign language, my quality of work obviously goes down, but like at some point it doesn't even feel like it's conscious, right? I am becoming a stochastic parrot. I'm like, well, I remember in the textbook it was supposed to be this, and I've heard someone use that on the internet. Maybe I didn't even know they were being sarcastic and I'm now sounding terrible.
Yeah, Stephen Wolfram actually makes this point too about LLMs, that they're computationally pretty shallow, actually. This is one of the reasons they're bad at math, because math is often about sort of recursively expanding a series of tokens into some sort of answer. And one of the things he notes is actually, it seems that human language is actually surprisingly computationally shallow. Like, it feels like it ought to be extremely recursively deep, but it does make me wonder, especially as a verbal processor myself, like, how many times am I just guessing next token? And maybe there's some process up there that's just sort of predicting whatever the next token ought to be.
Well, two thoughts real quick there. This reminds me of, like, what is it, the linguistic, like the fish. You know, whether the fish is a noun, a verb, an adverb.
Buffalo.
Wrong animal. See, that's my conscious. Well, that's my intelligence. I'm already a pea zombie. I don't even need a pea zombie. I'm already walking around without consciousness. But the other one is a novel that won, I believe, a couple of major literary awards, Ducks Newburyport. So this is about maybe 2 years ago, but 1,000-page novel with essentially a single sentence. The entire book is one sentence. It is about a 40-hour read, and it is one sentence. And throughout the whole thought, it's basically a stream of consciousness. It's basically the fact that, and there's some like paragraph, and then it's like the fact that is the entire book. And it works. It won a lot of literary awards. It actually is quite compelling. I've read pages, and then I was like, I can't. my context window and my LLM in my brain is just not capable of sustaining this. But I agree with both you, Sam and Gordon. You know, we just can't untease that. And so the question is are we limited in consciousness? You know, are we just, you know, I think of like Q on Star Trek. Like, is there just higher intelligences who are going to be able to, you know, put this all together in a unique way? But the last point I'll make, and then we'll move on, is when I think about LLMs, you know, there's one thing of like training and putting into the neurons, and yet we don't consider that consciousness, right? Because we only consider it consciousness when we can communicate with it, when we actually text with the chatbot and go into the black box. Because otherwise it's just a black box. We have actually no idea what's sitting there until we start to communicate it and do these tests. And I think that is particularly interesting as well, that even though we have the ability to inspect every neuron, we have all the stats, we have all the models, all the data stored in memory, like we have it fungible, we can look at it, we can inspect it, we don't consider that consciousness at all. It has to be through language by which we judge that. So the next topic was whether consciousness is necessary or not necessary for intelligence. And this was specifically about, I guess the main character is Rorschach. Did I get it right this time?
Yep, you're Rorschach.
Yes, exactly. I learn things every day on this podcast. We're talking about whether non-sentient but super intelligent Darwinian replicator, and we have a quote here: "Scramblers are the honeycomb, Rorschach is the bees." Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. So this is spoiler alert. This is like the big cosmic horror reveal of the book. Is that the we have this big scary kind of spaceship maybe looking thing, and then we have a bunch of like almost octopus like creatures within it that have a lot of neurons but don't seem to actually exhibit consciousness. They're good at solving problems but not self-reflective, and the question in the book is like, well, you know, which one is the alien? Is it the big like spaceship looking thing? Is it the thing within it? And his big reveal is that neither one is the alien. This thing is actually, it's more like a super intelligent virus, or like an ant colony where none of the ants are actually conscious either. It's a process that knows how to replicate itself and perform intelligent sort of actions in response to its environment and in response to feedback. But there's not a thing that it's like to be Rorschach. And one of the characters uses this example of honeybees. So interesting thing is like in a beehive, you have these nicely packed hexagonal cells, right? Like sort of beehive hexagons. And it turns out that mathematically, that's the most efficient way to pack a bunch of things together. And the question is like, how do bees know this actually? Like, where's that programmed in the neurons? And it's not actually. They're just, what the neurons are telling the bee to do is go around in a circle. A bee makes a tube. And what happens is as these tubes get pressed together, the pressure of the adjacent cells and the sort of like softness of the wax creates these hexes. It's the total system that is sort of producing this intelligent packing behavior. So scramblers, these sort of alien-like characters, are being kind of produced by this larger structure. And both of them are kind of like the honeycomb. It's like a series of mechanistic steps that are being carried out that produce this intelligent and even super intelligent behavior that the characters observe in the book.
I think the idea is, right, like intelligence is vital for self-preservation and like reproduction and like evolutionary fitness. But I think, yeah, like the really provocative argument is that consciousness is maybe this like weird, almost like evolutionary dead end, or it's actually like, and so the argument in the book, if I remember correctly, is that consciousness is actually a waste of resources because
it's inefficient.
When we are, right, like, it's inefficient. We are thinking about the world, we're focusing our attention on certain things. But if we didn't have to focus our attention, if we didn't have to have kind of lights on, we could actually be doing so much more. And so, yeah, and like, so these scramblers, which are, yeah, like, they're not sure, like, are these the aliens or is not? Like, they're nothing. They're just like, but they're able to just do so much more than humans can do because they don't have to think about what they are. Like, it's like,
yeah, Rorschach actually attacks because the people ask it to do this kind of recursive self-reflection, like conscious communication, and it interprets this as a virus, like, hey, you're asking me to run a runaway while loop, like, I'm not going to do that.
Right, it's like, or
instead
like,
I'm going to retaliate.
Kind of thing,
yeah.
Well, let's move on. So we talked a little bit about Fermi paradox. So I think you summarized that well. So let's go to the meat of the discussion, which was supposed to be its own section. We kind of integrated it throughout, which is LLMs. So, you know, fast forwarding into 2023, book was published, or at least the paperback. I looked at Amazon. Paperback was in 2008, so somewhere in the mid-2000s, let's call it. But we're 15 years into the forward, and these are sort of the core questions that are coming out today. You know, one of the references is to David Chalmers, who wrote a really popular book last year or the year before called Reality Plus, which has become sort of the Bible of the philosophy of virtual reality. So, you know, what are we seeing? There's a little bit of Baudrillard in there and like images and simulations, but then we're also getting consciousness, and are we beaming our consciousness across, you know, the ether, so to speak? But when we get to LLMs, you know, we for the first time have a statistical computer brain that seems on par with basic human thought. I don't think anyone is confusing it with AGI. or artificial general intelligence. You know, it doesn't seem like we've seen AutoGPT and some others try to be actors, but there's clearly huge breaks, and it seems very statistical and it seems very brittle. So it doesn't seem like we're close to AGI right now, but LLMs do seem to be able to replace real human work for workers who, in some cases, as I've written about in the securities newsletter, professionals and legal professionals and medical professionals and people who have, you know, serious degrees, both undergraduate and postgrad. And so what are we talking about when we get to intelligence and a lot of these sort of philosophical case studies, the Chinese Room, P-Zombies? You know, does it help us understand the LLM world better in some of the debates we're seeing in the media today?
Yeah, LLMs, they're intelligent. They're getting information and doing something about it. But are they conscious? Like, have we created a philosophical zombie? Sam, do you know?
I don't. I'm inclined to think that they are closer to philosophical zombies than actually conscious. I think, yeah. And they're clearly intelligent. And maybe this is like my like anthropocentric kind of view and like my human bias. Like they don't seem to be conscious. Mainly because the kinds of tests that are done in blindsight, in many ways, actually, the LLMs actually do pretty well on those kinds of things, but there are still ways of tripping them up.
Yeah.
That being said, I mean, humans also get tripped up unless they're like focusing really well. And so, like, so it's one of the things that, like, oh, like, is my consciousness kind of like a spectrum of like sometimes I'm really focusing and then I'm like really there, and other times I'm not. I am inclined to say they are probably closer to like philosophical zombies. I mean, I don't necessarily think they're like human level intelligent, but not conscious at all. I think they're like less than human intelligent, but still pretty intelligent, but not conscious. I don't know, Gordon, what do you think?
Well, yeah, I think I net out in a similar place, but then I have these kinds of maybe second opinions that come at me. So there's this paper called, it was Kaczynski 2023, called Theory of Mind May Have Spontaneously Emerged in Large Language Models. That was very controversial. But basically, this scientist subjected various flavors of GPT to the kinds of false belief tasks we use to test theory of mind in people. Is this person conscious? Do they have a theory of mind? So GPT-3 did about like at a 40%. GPT-3.5 was 90%, which is better than most six-year-olds. GPT-4 is 85%. This is weird. If it's a philosophical zombie, how does it have, you know, how does it do so well at theory of mind? It seems like it's embodying a great deal of information about the way people think. It also makes me wonder, so one of the proposals for where consciousness comes from, why we have it, is because we're a social species, and we need it for theory of mind. I need to be able to simulate Sam in my head and Danny in my head so that I can interact with them in a social way. But I don't know, since GPT is, you know, kind of computationally shallow and might be a philosophical zombie, what's actually going on here?
Well, I think one of the questions I have is how much does emotion, I mean, we talked about language, but how much does emotion become a key aspect of consciousness? That there's essentially, and when I say emotion, I mean some sort of signaling, some sort of complex signaling mechanism that offers you sort of feedback on what you're saying, how you're interacting with something. Because, you know, all of the LLMs as of today that are really popular are chatbots, right, which are basically emotionless vessels of pure text. And if you want emotion, you have to sort of ask for it, right? So, like, act angry when I say this. Write this in an angry voice. But part of consciousness, at least in my views, would seem to come from the fact that you have your own sort of feedback loops. And so as you're sort of interacting, there's sort of a real-time response in addition to the actual language that's coming back.
So one thing I would caution with that, and going back to, like, these, like, chatbots from, like, the 60s, 70s, like the Eliza one, there was another one that really, I think it was even less complex, but all it basically did was whatever you would say, it would just like curse at you and insult you. And it turns out that was even better at causing people to think it was really a person, because like insult and anger is like very stateless. And so you don't really have to like have like a large context. I remember this from like The Most Human from Brian Christian's book. And I think I kind of talked about this like a very like stateless kind of thing. And so I would say, we should caution. Yeah. I think emotion is an important component by it. It's an important component, but I would say it might make us even more easily tricked when we see like emotion in some of these, the Kevin Roos long chat with Sydney where it was like right. afraid of certain things or like, then there were a lot of emotions and everyone, and I think, and it might've been like the emotion was the thing that really kind of like caused people to have a great deal of concern. Like it was like, and so I think emotion is an important component. I don't know if it's like required. I mean, I think Data from Star Trek without his emotion chip probably was still conscious. At the same time though, like, emotion can also trick us, and so I would just be kind of like hesitant there.
Now let me ask, because I think you mentioned it, Gordon, you've read part two, and Sam, did you read part two?
Yeah, I have not.
So I'm curious, you know, just to close out the episode here, I'm curious, are the thought experiments just kind of continued in part two, or is there a whole nother like rendition of things going on in the second part of the duology?
Well, I got to say, part two is packed with even more ideas. And it continues to pull on a lot of these threads, as I mentioned. In addition to vampires, he adds a scientifically plausible zombie, a literal philosophical zombie. These are kind of like military grunts who get their consciousness like switched off for their tour of duty, basically. And he pulls on other sort of threads of cognition. There's other ones in both these books that we haven't even touched on, like tools as extensions of the self. And one of the things he also explores in the second book is this notion of super intelligent AIs, and that perhaps consciousness is like a phase that evolution passes through. So the idea is that actually they reach human level intelligence, they become conscious, they supersede human level intelligence, and they just sort of diffuse into an unconscious but super intelligent system, which is a pretty mind bending thing to contemplate.
It's like consciousness as like the moody teenager phase.
I will say, closing out, that Peter Watts, who is the author of Blindside, collected his thoughts and essays together under a title called Peter Watts is an Angry Sentient Tumor, which was published in 2019. So if that gets you a sense of, I think, of the author and the mode of thinking here, I think that's really great. But I think we've covered enough philosophy in one episode of Securities. Sam, our scientist in residence here at Lux, thank you for joining us. And Gordon, founder of Subconscious, a network of connecting your notes and socializing around them, and creating intelligence and consciousness out of all the thoughts in your head. Thank you both for joining us.